ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You can't control what you don't understand. I'm Ray Johnston, and in Opt Out, I'm taking back control of my digital life. Join me as I track down my data, lock down my accounts, and learn how to fight back. Opt Out, the Download This Show guide to getting off the internet. To hear it, search for Download This Show wherever you get your podcasts or hear it on the ABC Listen app.
Hi, I'm Tegan Taylor and this is Life Matters, where your stories shape the national conversation. Over summer, I've been revisiting some of your favourite stories from 2025. Today, we're discussing how to be happy alone. We all have a bit more choice in the matter, especially women, and have more options than ever before. And a lot of us are choosing to dedicate our lives to our own pursuits. Maybe you were in a relationship and decided it wasn't for you. Or maybe the commitment to being single has been a lifelong one. Also ahead, the rise in women choosing solo travel, packing up and booking that ticket before heading off on a one-person adventure. It's all coming up here on ABC Radio National. Once upon a time, you stood up in front of your friends and family, you looked into each other's eyes and said you wanted to grow old together. But now you are growing older and you're deciding to part. While overall divorce rates are at a 50-year low, more couples are splitting later in life, especially after 20 or more years of marriage. Nearly one in three divorces now involves someone aged 50 or older. This trend is leaving many suddenly single, facing housing stress, and returning to work to stay afloat. So let's take a look into the legal and psychological sides of why people are retiring their relationships around the time we'd usually be retiring from work. With me is Tamika Slee, a Brisbane-based divorce lawyer, and Carly Dober, a psychologist and policy coordinator with the Australian Association of Psychologists. Tamika, Carly, welcome.
No problem. Good morning.
Tamika, I'll start with you. In your practice, are you seeing a boom among older clients?
We absolutely are seeing a boom. I've been admitted to practice for 13 years now, and I remember once upon a time, you wouldn't really see anybody past kind of middle age. You know, it was middle age and younger people, not really many in the older age bracket. And now we're seeing lots of them, not just in our private practice, but in our mediation space as well. We're doing mediations for older couples. We've had lots of people in their 70s, 80s, 50s, 60s, of course, as well. But, you know, right through to the 80s.
13 years is kind of a long time. It's also not really a long time to see such a big swing in this direction.
No, it's not. But I also think a lot has changed in 13 years in terms of societal norms around divorce. I think it's much more accepted now. People are less likely to accept things that aren't making them happy, I suppose. People are more likely to say, look, this isn't working for me at any age, and I need to do something about that.
Carly, from your perspective, why are we seeing a rise in older people splitting up?
There's a lot of reasons why divorce might be an option for people in their older years. There can be financial stresses or financial changes of circumstance where maybe one person has come into a lot of money or lost a lot of money and they might separate just for the legal side of things, so neither of them are impacted in the same way. There can be caring changes, so when the kids move out, they've noticed that maybe they haven't actually nurtured their relationship and tended to one another and they feel like strangers. And they are just thinking, what do I want the next 30 years of my life to be?
I do want to talk more about the relational side of things, but I just wanted to unpack a little bit what you were saying about the money side of things. Are you saying that people are splitting up because they can't see eye to eye on money, or that they're splitting up for legal reasons to avoid getting the tax implications of their partner's money shift?
Both are common, but what we are finding is that mainly women have been impacted perhaps by being stay-at-home mothers for decades, and then they find they've got no super, nothing to their name and they aren't necessarily supported by their partner ongoing or don't feel like they are supported. And again, they're just thinking, well, what do I want the next 30 years of my life to be? What do I do from here?
Mm-mm. So you're mentioning one thing there. There's a whole lot of different things that make divorce more complicated when you're older.
Incredibly complicated. And we also know that older women in Australia are one of the fastest growing homelessness populations. So this is not a choice that comes by people easy. And we also know that rents across the country and housing insecurity are skyrocketing at the same time. So these two things in concert would make divorce a very, very tricky decision for a whole bunch of people.
On the text line, one person says people grow apart, kids grow up, some men chase younger pastures and ladies battle menopause. Very sad for all, especially women. Luckily, it hasn't happened to me. John says people are becoming more narcissistic. Carly, what do you say to that?
I think this is a term that's thrown around very willy-nilly. And I think, you know, everyone, every person sits on the narcissism spectrum because it's a trait that we all have. But to be a clinically diagnosed narcissist means that it is impacting your quality of life in a significant way. And I think maybe there's more of a social license for people to do what truly makes them happy compared to 30 years ago. You know, what their parents or grandparents would have wanted or what their culture or religion might have wanted. And so that freedom might come across as selfish to others.
Yeah, that freedom, Tamika, that's something you sort of mentioned just now as well, as that's what you're seeing in the clients that you're seeing. Once people have decided that this is what they want, they've then got to deal with the legal fallout of that. A lot of women, like you say, take time off to work to raise children. They might not have as much super as their partners. How are the people you're seeing navigating those imbalances in a relationship?
So in terms of the imbalance in superannuation, that's in the asset pool for division. So it's all factored in. One of the things that I think is really valuable is for people to get legal advice really early on in this decision-making process, because knowledge is power, and it can also offer people some comfort in a way, because they do find out, oh, hang on, the super's in there. You know, he doesn't get to keep all of that. That's all factored in. And also it can help in terms of getting to a resolution amicably, because you've had some legal advice, your expectations have been managed in terms of what it might look like for you. And then you can work towards a mediation process, for example, rather than a prolonged litigation.
You're listening to Life Matters here on Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor, and we're talking about so-called grey divorces, this trend towards people later in life, after many decades of marriage, deciding to call it quits. I'd love to know if this has been your experience. Tig, you recently split at 55.
I did. That's right, Tegan, yeah.
How did that come about?
It probably took a period of time to get to that point, but I guess it wasn't necessarily a mutual decision. You know, one of us decided that they were looking for something different, you know.
I'm hearing that wasn't you.
That wasn't me, no.
How did that conversation go?
Oh, look, it was over a period of time. You know, we'd been living overseas. We came back. We sort of came back separately, and I think, you know, probably, I don't know, like a lot of people at my age, I suppose, people start to rethink what it is that they're sort of looking for in life. I don't think that's uncommon, but, you know, I guess in this particular situation, what we were looking for in life sort of became markedly different.
Tig, do you mind me asking, it sounds like it's pretty fresh for you, maybe you haven't been able to work through this the whole way yet, but how have you processed this? How are you coping with it?
Look, it's a massive, you know, it's a massive readjustment, you know, for everyone involved. You know, you think about what it looks like financially in the future, and you know, the makeup of family, there are children involved. You know, I think I certainly have been working with a counsellor, and that's been terrific. You know, that's a really important part of working my way through this. And I think there's a growing number of people in this situation. So actually, talking to people who, there's nothing like talking to someone who's kind of had a similar experience, and lots of people are, people are very caring and listen, but there's nothing like talking to someone who has walked a mile in the same shoes. And so that, I think has been and remains a really important part of the sort of the process, I guess.
Absolutely.
Which it very much is a process of, rethinking what life looks like, at this stage of life.
Tig, thank you so much for the call. I really appreciate you sharing your story. It sounds like it's pretty fresh for you. Carly, just listening to that, what I'm hearing is on their wedding day, no one's thinking about splitting up. You're really looking to the future with a lot of optimism. And when couples split, you have to sort of reassess the vision of the future that you had for yourself.
Yeah, and that can be really difficult on so many levels, even when the divorce was wanted, right? Because it's a lot of logistical planning, it's a lot of emotional recalibration, and it can shift and shake the foundations of your family, friendships and community. And I really agree with the sentiment that it is so helpful to talk to people who have walked through it. But for many people, it can be quite catastrophic, especially if they've never seen it coming, because we know that one of the key psychological protective factors for all of us are our close social relationships. And when we are in our, older ages, that one of these people tend to be our romantic partners or our life partners. So when we split with them or we get divorced, who do we have left? And if you haven't cultivated friendships and maintained friendships, people can find themselves quite isolated and alone while adjusting to this massive loss.
Right, so you're not just losing a romantic partner, you're not just looking at the assets, but you're also losing part of your social connections there. That's so interesting. You are listening to Life Matters here on Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor, talking about the increase in number of couples in their 50s and beyond who are splitting up. On the text line, Jim says, I think it's happening because people have been unhappy for a long time and could not see it getting any better. Not all men or women end up worse off. Well, Tamika, let's talk about what it looks like when people have to do this, the legal side of it, splitting up those assets. Are people surprised about how little they end up walking away with?
Yes, people are often surprised. But I think that comes from not ever having looked at your asset pool and thinking, what does this look like if it's divided, for example? People are looking at their finances all of the time, but it's always a household kind of income, what they own as a pair. And it's not until you start sitting down and working through the asset pool, working through the figures, that the reality of what dividing it actually looks like hits.
What can people do? Again, no one wants to have to think about this. This is not a situation that you're dreaming about for your future. But what kind of steps should people be thinking about and at what time to protect themselves against getting blindsided by this later on?
So one of the big things that we're also seeing a real increase in is financial agreements, I think more colloquially known as prenups. Lots of people making inquiries about those at the moment. They can help in terms of setting out at the very beginning what it will look like if and when you separate. That said, they don't always avoid conflict at the end, but they do really help set those expectations, and it can offer a level of protection for the spouse who has come in with less, for example. That's one of the options. Another thing is to keep your eye across the finances as best you can. Have a good idea of what's going on in terms of bank accounts, investments, the home loan, your super, really keeping a top of those things. Because another thing that we often see is one person has predominantly managed the finances and another person, that's not really been their space, and they come in and they have no idea what their finances look like. And then that means the reality of how little they might walk away with or how much comes as an even bigger surprise.
You're listening to Life Matters here on Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor, talking about statistics showing us that more people are getting divorced in their 50s and beyond than before. Mark, you broke up after 30 years and it's been a massive change for you.
Yeah, it has. And it was a very complicated change. And in terms of, we just kind of, like, respectfully just ran out of steam. We'd moved on from each other. We'd done a lot of fantastic things together. And then unfortunately, not on my part, but there was some family violence on the other party's part, and that was very, very confronting. And there was the family court, and which I've got to say was fair, and I think the family court does a great job in trying to get people together to solve these issues. So, but you take a massive financial hit. But the important thing is, and I'd say this to everyone, remember that, and my children are of almost of adult age. I've got one in the Navy, et cetera, et cetera. They will always look back with adult eyes. And that's what we tried to keep in focus, that our children would look back with adult eyes as the way we behave towards each other. So we do communicate regularly, and I think you need to have that. But, you know, I've got friends going through it, and it's such a difficult path. I'll have to work longer now. There's no way I can retire when I wanted to. And that's just a reality. I'm lucky I'm not in a job that's not physical, so I can work longer. I've moved out of the family home, which is really hard. But it was either that or sell the family home, and I just went, no, I want my kids to have a place to always go to, you know, because in your 20s things can go wrong and you might need to come home. So that was financially difficult, scary. I'd never been in that position before. I was lucky enough as one of the sandwich generation to be able to afford to buy a home. Now, I'm renting for the first time. I haven't rented since I was a student.
Mark, it sounds like it sounds like it's been a huge upheaval in your life. Thank you so much for the call. And I really love that wisdom of that your kids will look back with adult eyes and to keep things respectful and fair there. So, Tamika, I suppose, what is your parting advice to people who are, you just want to insure yourself against anything that could happen in the future, I suppose?
My parting advice would be, as soon as a separation is on the horizon, get some legal advice. I really do believe that knowledge is power. It doesn't have to be at the point of separation. You can get some advice before you've separated. And as part of that process, you can talk about things that you can be doing before you make the final call to kind of get your ducks in a row, I suppose, to protect yourself, to make sure that you're going into the process with the knowledge that you need, making the most of a period where you might still be able to talk to each other. So I think that's really the best advice I can give. Get some legal advice and then try and work it out amicably, work towards a mediation rather than litigation, because once you've made this call, you don't want to spend the next few years in a messy separation process. If you can work it out amicably, that's always going to be great.
Tamika Slee is a Brisbane-based divorce lawyer, and Carly Dober is psychologist and policy coordinator with the Australian Association of Psychologists. We're coming up here on Life Matters on ABC Radio National, why so many women are packing up, booking that round-the-world ticket and taking that once-in-a-lifetime trip solo.
On ABC Radio National,
the arts aren't just entertainment.
They're part of who we are.
Andy Griffiths.
He ended up at the centre of the earth fighting the peanut butter beast.
Now, Ben O'Cree.
Put their hands up if they have never been brokenhearted.
The changing nature of performance and recording in Australia.
From books to music and far beyond, the arts are just one way Radio National
explores the world in full.
If you've scrolled social media recently, you've probably noticed a friend or a colleague or your friend or colleague's mum posting photos of themselves from some exotic and far-flung location. And what stands out? They're gloriously alone. One US tourism market research firm, Future Partners, has found nearly 40% of female travellers were interested in taking a solo trip in 2025. That's up 8% from that number in the previous year. And more travel companies are offering solo trips for women. It seems that the attitude of a growing number of women is, why wait any longer to embrace that big adventure? Elia Navarro describes herself as a solo backpacker and happy little traveller. Elia, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
So your line sounds a bit patchy because you're travelling right now. Where are you?
I am very on brand for this story. I'm currently in a little fishing village in Bali called Ahmed. And, yeah, if you hear any roosters and stuff in the background, that's why.
So talk to me about what are you seeing at the moment where you are?
Well, I'm huddled up where the Wi-Fi is best at the reception, but if I look up, the sun is rising and it's a beautiful day by the ocean. So, yeah, it'll be a nice day to enjoy the tropical island vibes here.
Yeah, I'm a bit jealous. So tell me, like, your travel street cred is pretty impressive. How many countries have you been to and where have you been by yourself?
So I've been to 47 countries so far, and a lot of them I've been to more than once. And so many, almost all of them I have kind of been to by myself at some point. But I'd say my best like street cred flexes are the really long trips I've done by myself, mostly through Europe for like 4 months at a time. And I think that they've definitely, yeah, given me the biggest rewards in terms of, you know, learning how to be a good solo traveler, because there's some things you need to learn the hard way sometimes.
Okay. What sort of things?
I think just, you know, having confidence in yourself, having confidence to go up and say hello to strangers, and not having anyone to rely on when things start to go wrong, and having to, you know, get good at problem solving. And I started solo traveling when I was 19, so I barely had those skills at home, let alone on the road. So it was a bit of a baptism by fire, but it was the best way to do it and the most fun way for sure.
19 is definitely the age that I think a lot of people are traveling with mates. Why did you decide to strike out on your own?
Actually, I just couldn't find anyone that wanted to go at the time. And I felt like if I didn't go, then I would just kind of never go. So I think it's a really good lesson for anyone who wants to get into solo traveling, is that you can't, if you wait around for someone else to give you permission or to accompany you, you just might never do it, because time passes and people get busy and things change. So if you want to do it, just do it by yourself. It's really not that scary, and you'll find people already there doing it.
So tell me what the most important lesson is that you've learned, so that none of us have to learn it the hard way.
Probably I'd say just honestly saying hello to strangers and just assuming that everyone's kind of a friend you haven't met yet, because usually on the other side of the scary hello is like some of the best relationships and days you'll have on the road. So yeah, get over yourself and just go up and say hello, because you never know what kind of adventures that might lead to. And especially as a solo traveler, you're so flexible to just kind of pick up on other people's plans and change your plans and stuff. So it usually leads to some really good times. And I'm actually traveling right now with a friend I met on my very first trip in Japan when I was 19, and she's from France, and we've met all these years later. So it's a beautiful thing that can come out of these solo backpacking relationships you make.
I love that so much. How gorgeous. Had you seen each other in the intervening years?
We kind of met, even stayed in Paris for quite a few weeks, seeing her baby when she had her baby, and we've got her little three-year-old here now with us and her mum. So yeah, it's a beautiful kind of family affair now from these like cross-country relationships. It's really sweet.
Across the countries and across the years. Aaliyah, we'd better let you get back to the sunrise and the roosters and your French mate. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Solo traveller extraordinaire Aaliyah Navarro there. We're talking about embracing big adventures solo. Jane says, I've travelled solo for most of my life, over 50 years. First time, just turned 19 in 1973. I just can't wait for other people to get it together, but I meet others along the way. Now 70 and still travelling. Jane, you're my hero. So I want to get a sense of the big picture when it comes to women and solo travel. Catherine Koo is a professor of business and hospitality at Torrens University, and her research focuses on women travellers. Catherine, welcome. So we're seeing more and more women hit the road by themselves. What's behind this upward trajectory?
Right. There are so many different reasons. One is this changing attitude around marriage and family. And then, you know, women want to travel to challenge themselves. And there's so many stories like that on social media now that encourages each one of us to do that, you know, so people find courage when they didn't have it before. So that kind of propels this. And then post-COVID, you know, people want to do travel. And like Aaliyah's case, in our research, we actually found that, yeah, people travel solo because they cannot find anyone else to travel with. So her story kind of confirms the findings that we have.
The word that she used when she was describing her reasons was not waiting for permission. And I feel like that is, yes, obviously men travel solo as well, and we will talk about that. But that feels like a very female thing to say.
Yeah. I think, there's so many discourse on how we do womanhood, right? Like how we are always the provider to so many different people in different aspects of our life, the roles we play as daughter, mother, and then, in-law, friend, colleague, and even at work, we are the nurturer, right? We are always something, a role to someone. And being on the road, you lose all of that. You're just living life for yourself. You don't have to take care of anyone else. And that's one of the things that our participants told us in our study too.
So you mentioned COVID as people wanting to get back out again. What about the role of social media where you're just like people only post their really great travel photos? So it really feels like everyone is traveling all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, some people like Alia, like she says, she travels she's on the road at extended period of time. And we just published a paper on solo female van lifers who are people who travel in prolonged mobility. And that's a different, story altogether. But yeah, people, not everyone travel all the time. Sometimes people do take the plunge and do, 1 week of solo travel or just maybe 2 days of solo travel.
So why did you decide to focus on women in your research, Catherine? Because obviously everyone's traveling. Why women for you?
Okay, so obvious reasons. I am a woman and I am, I have a restless spirit. I travel a lot on my own and I had so many questions and I was undergoing so many different constraints. And I wanted to research this and see what is the extent of this surface level thoughts that I have. And then the research has got bigger and bigger and it's been a 15-year journey since.
So that's your area of expertise, but mm-hmm. You are in this industry, you are looking at travel patterns. When we're saying that we're seeing upticks in women interested in traveling solo, are we seeing similar travel patterns in men?
So men have always been more likely to travel solo, but the percentage of women wanting to travel solo or are traveling solo are increasing at a bigger rate than the increase in men, if that makes sense.
Is that because men were always doing it solo before or are they less likely?
Because travel was invented, it was created by men, right? Like travel was, men were the geographers, the conquerors, they were the ones who were traveling and women were the, taking care of home and then they started traveling. But we didn't have these stories of women traveling or, there were a lot of barriers to stop the stories of women who are traveling, to put them in their place.
We are talking about women embracing big adventures and men solo on Radio National Life Matters this morning. I'm Tegan Taylor. And I was thinking when you were speaking before, Catherine, about that idea of the grand tour, that UK gentry men would sometimes do that. Like young men, they finish school, maybe they finish university and they go off and have a tour. This idea of striking out and being an adventurer wasn't confined to like people climbing Mount Everest, but was also something that was sort of a rite of passage for young men. But you're saying that really wasn't part of the story for young women until quite recently.
Yeah, I mean, it was there. Women were traveling, but the stories of them traveling just were not made visible. And women have, we published a book on women in Victoria times who travel, and that's where we uncovered all of these stories of empowerment, emancipation, and most of the time these women, they travel during significant life transitions, whether it's, graduation, death of a spouse or, things like that.
Steve has called in. You know a solo woman traveller, Steve?
Yes. My wife, roughly in sort of early mid-40s, my wife got interested in ecotourism some years ago. When she had a long service leave being a teacher, she went across to Kenya for 2 to 3 months and taught in a Maasai village there, volunteer taught in a Maasai village for about 2 months at the time she was gone. So that involved living in the Maasai village, I think in like a tin hut eating what they ate and then walking 10K each day to the school and back to teach and basically lived with them for the 2 months.
Did you have much contact with her? Did you have much contact with her while she was away?
Not much. Occasionally a phone call when she could. There was a period where she got particularly sick. She'd had all the vaccinations, but she picked up can't remember what it was, something similar to hepatitis from eating contaminated veggies. And I hadn't heard from her for a week or so, and apparently she'd sort of been in hospital. But luckily there were a couple of other female travellers with her who happened to be nurses and they looked after her during that time. But it was a tremendous experience for her, something that she wanted to do. When she came
back, was she different or was she, you know, was she excited? What did she sort of talk about reflecting on that experience?
I suppose, she certainly was excited. I suppose just living with the Maasai and how they lived, their difficulties, like seeing these young kids, like the 5 or 6 year olds, they'll go outside with a herd of cows outside the protected compound area during the days so their animals can graze, and all they've got is like a 600ml bottle of water, and they're out there all day during daylight hours tending their cattle in the midst of lions and sort of other animals as well. So, and the other thing that struck her was how much the kids wanted to learn, because it's secondary school there, they have to pay for their education, so they might go to a couple of school for a couple of years, and then they might have to go and work for a number of years, and then they might sort of come back and do another year, like 2 or 3 or 4 years later on, once they've got the money again. So there was quite a wide range of ages at the school where she was teaching. So
it sounds like such an eye-opening experience. Steve, thanks so much for calling.
No worries at all.
And Joanne, you've also been a solo traveller basically your whole life.
My whole life, I exist solo, so it's, but I enjoy it. And just your last caller just reminded me that my first trip was backpacking through Indonesia in 1976 when I was 17, turning 18. And I called my parents once from the Denpasar post office on Christmas Day. And so the entire 3 months, and I just reflect now, my poor mother. My poor mother, she had no idea where I was. But then, fast forward to now, I just did 6 weeks in America on my own. I drove in Manhattan, actually drove a rental car, had to return it to Hertz in midtown Manhattan. Tell you what, that's probably something I won't do again. That was a pretty frightening experience. But what all I've really got to say out of all of my experiences, it is incredibly liberating for a woman to be able to travel on her own. It is one of the most liberating and enjoyable experiences.
What did that mean for you in real terms, Joanne?
It's freedom, basically. It's freedom to go where you'd like to go, choose what you'd like to do, and whether you'd like to spend more time or less time in a particular location. There's a lot more flexibility. And also, traveling solo, I think you're more open to meeting more people and becoming involved in more different experiences because you're on your own, because people tend to view, I think, couples as doing their own thing, and couples tend to travel as couples, I suppose, or more in groups. But when you're on your own, you're open, I think. You're more open, and that's part of the liberation.
Joanne, thanks so much for sharing. Catherine Koo, I can see you nodding furiously when these people are telling their stories. It obviously is very much vibing with what you found in your research.
That's right. And also, when Joanne was talking, I see the faces of all my past participants. And when I was there in the room to hear them tell their stories, it's so heartening. It's just, I was even tearing a bit when Joanne was talking about Denpasar and, her poor mother. Yeah.
Yeah, the experience of travel and being able to keep in touch is very different now to the way it was back in the 70s. And as we're sort of hearing, solo adventures have no age limit. on Radio National Life Matters, we're talking about women and men embracing big adventures solo. Margaret Yates's PhD is very much focusing on women travellers with a focus on solo women over the age of 60. Margaret, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So you've interviewed 29 women, and most of them are solo travellers, specifically road tripping in Australia. What's a typical participant like?
Well, of the 29 women, as you said, most of them were over 60, not by design, but just it was just the way that the study happened. What my whole plan was to find out who these women were, why they travelled, and importantly, what they did about their health, because I'm a registered nurse. What about they did about their health whilst they're out in the middle of nowhere? So, but in order to answer the health question, I had to understand who they were in the first place. So the findings from my research are, the first one was, as your previous speakers were just talking about, was the sense of freedom and liberation and being able to do what they wanted, when they wanted, without having to account for anybody else. And, yeah, that was probably the biggest finding. Then they talked about their sense of adventure. They were out there having a whole lot of fun, finding it exciting to travel across Australia and do new things, explore new places, meet new people. So they were just having a ball. They talked to me about their sense of safety. They consider that the lifestyle, being on the road, is very safe. None of my participants had any problems with any sort of untoward episodes by, you know, individuals or people that might harass them. And their health, a lot of them had, because of the age group, had chronic illnesses, but they didn't consider that they thought they were pretty healthy, really. And their lifestyle, they think, actually improved their health because it's less stressful. There's less, you know, less of everything apart from the enjoyment of being on the road.
It does sound overwhelmingly positive. Were there downsides, or did they face opposition from family members?
Yeah, one participant talked about her family saying, "Oh no, you can't do that. You can't get out there on your own, and you'll never cope." When in fact, that probably motivated her more to do it. She had two daughters also that actually supported her, but the rest of her family weren't that keen. She's now been on the road more than 10 years. I spoke to her just a few days ago, actually, and she said, "Oh, still loving it. Going to do it till she dies. Just absolutely loves it." So she wasn't put off by the opposition.
Such interesting research, Margaret, and really sort of borne out with this text from Jessica. She's 61. She said, I started travelling solo in my 50s due to change in circumstances, but my confidence grew significantly with Facebook groups for over 50s travelling solo. They offered a lot of support and encouragement. Jessica finishes, it's been life-changing. And so there are that sort of support groups around to sort of help people. Jennifer, You were solo travelling quite a while ago. You travelled by ship 67 years ago.
It was 57 years ago.
Only 57 years ago.
I'm 80 now, but very few people flew then. It was too expensive, so the ships leaving Sydney were loaded with young Australian women all going on working holidays to Europe. So I was one of those, and I would have liked to have gone with someone else at the time, but a lot of my friends were now getting married and having children and whatnot, so no one wanted to go. And it was an adventure of a lifetime. I was away from home for 2 months less than 3 years, and there was no communication with home at that time. It was only aerogram letters in the mail. There were no mobile phones. My parents didn't even have a phone then in the house. So we were all in the same situation, and you looked forward to letters from home or cards, birthday cards and whatnot. But I remember I had my 25th birthday in London, and no cards arrived for my birthday because it was a mail strike in Sydney. And a week later, about 20 cards arrived. And the postman said to me, "There are a lot of cards for you today. What was it for?" And I said, "Well, it was my birthday a week ago."
Oh, my gosh, Jennifer. It just baffles me how much our lives and society have changed in the space of a lifetime.
Exactly. We didn't have credit cards, so I took traveller's cheques. But I worked in London and I worked in Rome. I worked in Rome for nearly 8 months and stayed another 3 months in Rome because I'd made friends. But I loved travelling on my own. I made some nice friends. I met the locals. And it was wonderful.
That's beautiful. Jennifer, thanks so much for sharing. I hope there's still some more trips in your future.
Chris, I'm still travelling, but I'm travelling with my husband now.
Well, there you go. That's nice. A companion for the journey. Christine, you started travelling solo more along the lines of Margaret Yates's work when you were in your late 60s.
Yes, yes.
Where'd you go?
I did. So it was during the first and second years of COVID, and I'd always been interested in caravanning, and my husband started out with me and didn't enjoy it as much as I did, and I just decided, I think I can do this, and I had a go, and I drove a caravan on two big trips around New South Wales, confined to New South Wales, and then the next trip I could get across the Queensland border, and I did some travelling in southeast Queensland and came home, and it was a terrific experience. And what I have learned is women don't be fooled. It is just skill. Managing a caravan by yourself, driving, reversing, parking, map reading, they're just skills. You don't need heaps of strength. Balanced with that, of course, is the kindness of strangers everywhere you go in caravan parks. And I returned the kindness. I returned it forward. So when I was a novice, I needed a little bit of help on the odd occasion, but then I realised I was becoming one of the old hands.
That's such a good feeling to be able to be an old hand and show someone how it's done. Christine, thank you so much for the call.
Okay, thank you, Tina. Bye-bye.
Bye. And John has a story about travelling solo. John, I apologise already. We talked a lot about women in the story so far, but you've got a story too.
I do. And rightly so, you've been talking about women. I took up hiking the Heisen Trail solo. I'm about 700 kilometres up a 1,200-kilometre trail, and I could have found a mate or somebody to walk it with, but I decided I was going to take on the extra challenge and do it, and I've taken every step of it on my own. And I can tell you that it's been an amazing experience. I've really, really – because you've got no one to talk to, no one to chat to, you – go deep, deep inside your head. You've got nothing else to do but walk and think for 8-10 hours a day. And things come into your head you haven't thought about for many, many years. And it really built my sense of confidence and a real sense of self-achievement. And interestingly, in all of my trails, I've run into many other solo hikers. I have never run into another man who's solo hiking. It's always women.
Is that I've right?
That is so true. And that could be young, that could be old, middle-aged, every age. But women, I don't know, it seems to appeal to them more, perhaps. But far, far more often I run into women on the trail with a hiking solo and not a man yet. But I remember that very first walk I did, which was a real test for me because I hadn't done anything like it before. I walked 5 days from the head of the trail to a place called Victor Harbour. So I basically walked into the bush for 5 days with everything on my back, including food, mattress, everything, inflatable mattress, all on my back. And when I walked into it hardly stopped raining for about 3 or 4 days. But when I walked into Victor Harbour, I walked up to my car and I had the emotion just overwhelmed me and I just bawled my eyes out. And I don't know what it was, relief, it was exhaustion, mental and physical. And I was just so proud of myself and it changed me as a person for the better. And I recommend it to anybody. Just get out there, get walking, get out in the bush, buy some cheap, nasty gear if you don't know how to get into it, because you can go into one of these big brand hiking places and spend thousands. Don't do it. Just buy some cheap, nasty stuff to get you going. But just get out on the trail, get out amongst nature, go into your head and just enjoy it for what it is. You know, it's an amazing pastime. I'm glad I stumbled across it.
So did you say you're 700 k's into the 1200? Are you on the trail at the moment?
No, unfortunately I have to pay tax for a living, so I've had to break it up into sections and I achieve it that way. There, I did run into some through, what you call a through hiker, which is someone who's doing the whole trail in one go. The only person I've struck who's doing that was, again, a young lady, probably in her early 20s, and she expected her to take her about 80-odd days without a break, just walking sort of 8 to 10 hours a day. And I think she might have been raising money for charity or something at the time. But, yeah, there, all the intrepid people out there doing this, they're women.
That's whatever incredible. Reason. John, thank you so much for sharing your story. And one quick final chat with Greg, you did a big long walk while you were doing your PhD.
No, not a walk. This was about the maggots.
Oh, right. Tell me quickly.
Well, essentially, when I was a PhD student, we organised a conference in the Barossa Valley, and one of the mini symposia that we had was on forensic entomology versus conventional forensic science. And so the thing that really I remember mostly is seeing a film that was done by one of the master's students when she was looking at pigs and the strike of the pigs with the various blowflies and whatnot. And it was time-lapse, so you saw the pig blow up and then deflate and the maggots on the eyes and all the soft parts, and it was just gruesome. It really was. But you didn't have the smell. There's no odorama.
The benefit of watching that on video instead of in real life. Greg, thanks so much for the visual. Yeah.
But she did it in a back shed down at Semaphore in Adelaide.
Can't imagine her neighbours were very impressed.
I'm not sure how the neighbours coped with it, but anyway, it was just quite amazing.
Greg, thank you so much for the call. So, Catherine Koo, in terms of your research, I saw you nodding when we heard, I think it was Jennifer, talking about travelling abroad as a young woman 50, 60 years ago. It's obviously not that much of a new trend.
No. Yeah, this was the one I was talking to you about at the start, where we were retrieving stories of women going overseas on big ships. And their experiences are not much, you know, like the logistical things like communication are very different, but actually the stories of emancipation and empowerment are not much different, actually. So, yeah.
Thank you, Margaret Yates. Margaret is a PhD candidate from the University of Technology, Sydney, who's researching women travellers. And thank you to Catherine Koo, Professor of Business and Hospitality at Torrens University. You also heard from solo travel Elia Navarro, who called us from Bali. If you're a pet parent, you know the comfort and company your furry companion can provide. But do you love them enough to bring your dog or cat or budgie on a plane with you? The airline Virgin now allows small pets to travel in its plane cabins, But when they first made the announcement that this was coming, it sparked heated debate online, with some people branding it ridiculous and disgusting and kind of querying whether we're treating our fur babies a little too much like real babies. Are the lines getting blurry? Well, Jackie Rand is Executive Director of the Australian Pet Welfare Foundation and an Emeritus Professor at the University of Queensland's School of Veterinary Science. Jackie, welcome to Life Matters.
Thank you, Tegan.
What are your thoughts on Virgin allowing animals in the cabins of the aircraft?
I think it's terrific and it's well overdue.
Okay.
Many airlines, and I just looked on the internet, and 21 airlines so far are listed as allowing it, and big names that people would know, you know, Air France, Lufthansa, United Airlines, Air Canada. So it's been well received there. And Tegan, you know, animals are so important in our lives. And what people forget is that even if you don't own an animal, it actually benefits you, because the astounding thing is that it's been shown that pet owners use doctors 11% less often than non-pet owners, and that eases the stress on the health system by an estimated 2.8 million doctor's visits a year, saving the whole community and the national health costs of $1.25 billion a year.
So if I can't get an appointment with my GP, it's because not enough people have a pet.
Maybe it's because you don't have a pet. In fact, there was a very interesting paper that's just been published this year, which showed that on a life satisfaction scale of 1 to 7, that owning a dog or a cat increased your satisfaction score by 3 to 4 points, which is just amazing. And
that's
we know,
wonderful for me, though. Like, my life of satisfaction has gone up 3 to 4 points. But if I'm sitting next to someone else's dog on a plane, maybe my life satisfaction is going down.
Well, what they're going to be in designated rows, from my understanding. They have to be the whole container and the pet has to weigh 8 kilos or less and fit under the seat. But they will be in designated rows. So. And you can't ask for a seat not next to a kid that's crying, but you won't, they will be pet designated rows. So if you don't want to sit in a pet designated row, then you won't be.
Maybe if you do feel like having a little pat of someone else's dog on the plane, you can ask to be seated in the pet row. I guess we'll see when that comes out.
Well, you won't be allowed because they have to stay in the carrier, but it's actually quite interesting, because we know that, particularly if you're walking a dog, it increases social interaction, because people ask you about your dog's name, not your name, often. And I can see that happening when people are walking off the plane with their pet. You know, people start, you know, who don't have a pet there, but have pets, will start to ask some questions. So I can see that it will increase social interaction. And a lot of people are really scared of flying, and I think, you know, to have that security knowing your pet's there in front of you could help that.
This is Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor talking to Jackie Rand, who's the Executive Director of the Australian Pet Welfare Association, about a new announcement by Virgin that small pets might be allowed to go in plane cabins soon, by the end of the year. Asking you what your thoughts are around our fur babies and how much they're part of our daily lives. Another text says, I have a really strong position on the anthropomorphising of companion animals. Yes, there's an overlapping of species characteristics and we have a bond as an interspecies family, but too many humans impose humanness on their pets and this denies them their own critter identity and it confuses them. Jackie, talk to me about this fur baby shift that we've seen in recent years.
Well, I mean, some people will describe them as fur babies. I've got two cats and now I've just got the one dog. But, you know, they're always happy to see you, not like some people in your life. And it actually has been shown in the study about life satisfaction that pet companionship can potentially be viewed as a substitute for human relationships at home. And I think many of us are lonely, and having a pet does make you feel better. And what's wrong with that? The pet certainly, I mean, I know when my dog comes to me with, you know, a big happy smile on his face and, you know, the ears bouncing as he runs along, you know, I don't think he's suffering. And, you know, he's still a dog at the end of it.
Jackie, thanks so much for joining me. Jackie Rand is Executive Director of the Australian Pet Welfare Foundation and an Emeritus Professor at the University of Queensland School of Veterinary Sciences. And that is it for Life Matters today. Catch up on any of the stories from today or any day. You can find them all on the ABC Listen app. And I'll catch you tomorrow.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.